Right. Good morning. Let's see. I guess I should say the date as often as done. So today's April 22nd, 2018, Earth Day. And it occurred to me that it's quite ridiculous that we have to have an Earth Day one day a year to remember how important this place we call home is. And it dawned on me that once a week we have garbage day. Maybe we can switch those around. So I guess to start out, I mentioned to Roshi a couple weeks ago that I had been collecting a lot of material on depression, and with the intention of doing a Zenbo article. I've been collecting stuff for over the past year or two, or maybe longer. And then it finally dawned on me that I was never going to get around to it because I hate writing. And I think it just would come out better and more personal as a talk. So threw that out there to him, and to my surprise, it was John said, "Okay, you're on in 2 weeks." So I wish I had a couple more weeks to prepare, but I always waited till the last minute for everything, so I guess I'll just go with the flow. So yeah, this is partly personally therapeutic for me, but I also, as I've opened up to people over the years about after being diagnosed with major depression disorder, I realize how many people are affected by it, either personally or by a loved one, family member who's gone through it, and just wanted to help to get out of the shadows and the kind of the family shame arena or whatever that is so common in this culture. We have to pretend like we're all perfect and strong and whatever. But so I figured it might be worth just offering a little bit of a warning and a disclaimer here. You may hear some profanity, and there will be discussion of suicide. So if that's difficult for anybody, you know, feel free to do what you got to do. And then also the disclaimer that I'm not a healthcare professional, nor am I a Zen teacher. This is simply based on my own experiences, and as is often said with various mental illnesses, if you met one person with depression, then you've met one person with depression, and everybody's experience is different. So yeah, I guess I'll just dive in here with some of the cut and dry stuff. It's hard to decide how much to include, but so we'll start off with an article I found from Scientific American, February 7th, 2013, by a Faris Jaber, J-A-B-R, and it's titled "Researchers Take a Closer Look at the Most Common and Powerful Triggers of Depression." So the current guidebook for psychiatrists, the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, number 4, or the DSM-4, defines a major depressive episode as at least 5 characteristic symptoms of depression persisting 2 weeks or longer. Symptoms include low mood and energy, insomnia, feelings of worthlessness, diminished pleasure in daily activities, and weight change. To meet the criteria for a diagnosis, the symptoms must interfere with one's personal or social life. The taxonomy of events that precipitate a major depressive episode is vast and diverse. Some people become depressed after learning that they have a serious illness, after a natural disaster destroys their homes, or when they fail to achieve important goals. Depression is also prevalent among those who have survived rape and war. The most common trigger of depression is loss, which takes many different forms, including economic misfortune, unexpected unemployment, and the loss of cherished possessions. According to large surveys, around 44% of depressive episodes are preceded by, quote, interpersonal loss, such as the death of a loved one, divorce, the end of a romantic relationship, or the fact that a close friend has moved to another part of the country. In other words, a severed connection with another person probably triggers more depression than any other kind of painful experience. An event that catalyzes a depressive episode does not have to be catastrophic. Sometimes what seems like mild stress or a minor loss to most people is enough to plunge someone into murky misery that refuses to fade. It all depends on an individual's vulnerability to depression, which is determined by a complex interaction of many different factors, including sources of stress in one's life, family history of mental illness, cognitive style, that is, the patterns of thought unique to an individual, and psychosocial factors, such as adversity in early childhood and the presence or absence of caring relatives and friends. Someone with low vulnerability and no previous depressive episodes may survive a devastating hurricane or emerge from a period of grief following the death of a sibling, having never experienced true depression. In contrast, someone at high risk of depression with little social support might fall into the depths of despair for months on end after a budding romance wilts and withers. So yeah, it became clear to me that I had a real misunderstanding of the word depression, and I think it's pretty common as I've come to do some research and talking to people, because the word is just, as I heard in one podcast, a woman, I think it was her name was Anita Barrows, and she's a psychologist and poet and Buddhist, Theravadan Buddhist practitioner, but she said that it just the word depression just doesn't do justice to what the experience is for anyone who's experienced that. They they'll know what I'm talking about, because you know, what we see or what we hear of depression, if you haven't experienced it personally, you know, as you think of like the teenage girl who's, oh my God, I'm so depressed, Billy dumped me, oh, it's so depressing, or that movie was so depressing. And then we have, you know, the Great Depression, which, okay, yeah, it was a low point in the economy, but hey, we bounced back and everything was, so I, instead of reading so much, because I don't want to read that much, I decided to try to play some clips from various podcasts that I've found really inspirational, and I have been really helpful, and I think hearing the person's actual voice in these interviews will go deeper for many people. This one podcast, it's called On Being, and it's hosted by a Krista Tippett, and this episode is titled The Soul in Depression from March 22nd of this year. And this first clip is by interview with Andrew Solomon, PhD. He's a writer and lecturer in politics, culture, and psychology, winner of the National Book Award, and an activist in the LGBT rights, mental health, and the arts. He is a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University Medical Center. And actually, it was an interview with him or a on a TED Radio Hour podcast that really turned things around for me, hearing him describe his personal experience. And it was sort of like it, and this was just maybe 2 years ago, a year or two ago, that, and you know, I was diagnosed 10 years ago, so it was always just something that was kind of that typical stigma, and just thinking that, you know, it's so hard to describe to people, and I think he just did such a great job, and I'll play and let it speak for itself here. Let's see if I can get it here. Of course, I'm going to have some issues.
You know, Andrew questioners tended to focus on his...
Okay, let's start. I'm going to start it over here.
What struck me as I listened, as a survivor of depression myself, was how Andrew Solomon's questioners tended to focus on his physical collapse and not on his eloquent insistence between the lines that depression for him was also a spiritually revealing experience. And Andrew Solomon is not a religious person. His mother's death when he was 27 triggered his first major depression. As he's recounted, she committed a planned suicide in the presence of him, his father, and his brother to end a bitter struggle with cancer. He now traces the onset of his depression from his incapacity to grieve the death of his mother.
The passage from grief into nothingness was very alarming and very strange. There was a sense, I mean, I still would have said, you know, I'm terribly upset that my mother died and so on and so forth, but the feeling went out of it. And
right.
I think that's why when the feeling comes back, you think, oh, this is a soul, this is a spirit, this is something profound and alive, which returned to me after taking a leave of absence.
I think what I found really refreshing about your book, and something that I don't think is out there enough, is, you know, what depression really is and what it really is not. It's not sadness, really. I think you say that the opposite of depression is human vitality.
It's an experience, I think, overall, of finding the most ordinary parts of life incredibly difficult, finding it difficult to eat, finding it difficult to get out of bed, finding it difficult and painful to go outside, being afraid all of the time and being overwhelmed all the time. And frequently, it's quite a sad experience to be afraid and overwhelmed all the time. Nonetheless, those are the essential qualities of it. It isn't, I think, primarily an experience of sadness.
Right.
And it teaches you how big emotion is. The profundity of the inner self, I suppose, would be the best way of putting it.
Yeah, it was that that comment that, thinking of it as, I think many of us have the idea that depression is sadness, or it's the, yeah, you know, that happiness is the opposite of depression. And I can say from my personal experience, when I was in the worst moments of it, I would have given anything to feel sadness. It was just a feeling of just emptiness, but not in the way that we like to talk about in Zen. It was just, I felt like just a shell with no feeling whatsoever, just disconnected from the outside world. Couldn't really taste food, didn't have any interest in food, smelling things, things just couldn't smell. What I've described to people, when I would try to describe it so somebody can kind of experience or get a sense of it, is it felt like having the worst flu you could imagine, just minus the fever. And even with some nausea and bowel issues, if the anxiety was intense enough, just all I could do is lay in bed, and even the thought of getting up to go get something to eat or just go get the mail was just so exhausting. And that's what's really hard to convey to somebody who doesn't quite understand it. Let's see here. This one is from another podcast, and it's called The Hilarious World of Depression, hosted by John Moe. And he interviews a lot of people in entertainment and, you know, the stereotypical comedians who are dealing with depression. Then, I mean, just as I've come to terms with this, just realizing that that's how I really I've always been interested in comedy and just really appreciate the comedians that can kind of traverse that kind of the darker side of life and then find some humor in it. But this podcast for anybody, it's just it's been really helpful. So this one was with Linda Holmes, and she is the host of a podcast, NPR podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour. And before that, she was an attorney working at the Minnesota Legislature. Let's play this.
So, adolescent Linda Holmes has a loving family, a body that doesn't fit the societal image of acceptable, alleged friends with a cruel streak, and depression. It adds up to not being okay with who she was.
I thought, I'm a good person, but I just have to fix everything. I think I always had this dream that I would become beautiful and become cool and kind of reinvent myself. And I think I tried to reinvent myself over and over again, probably into my 30s. I was sort of addicted to the idea of fresh starts. And when you talk about compartmentalizing, I think I was sort of addicted to the idea of walling off all of my struggles and mistakes and all those like sad memories and just being a completely new person who hadn't done anything yet. And that's a really, I think, tempting thing for a lot of people. And it was.
Yeah, so I can definitely relate to that of, looking back, I was always, once I kind of hit a rough patch in life, I would try to just pack up and try something new, find something new, and just avoid that, whatever was bothering me. And it really got to a point where I stopped running and had to deal with it. That was when things really started to, started to shift, and kind of the idea of acceptance and really just getting into the nitty gritty and dealing with things. After leaving staff years ago in early 2000s and falling in love and getting married, and which was the best thing that ever happened to me. There was some excitement after leaving staff. I was getting started up in starting my business, doing carpentry, woodworking, all that, and just so much going on. It was just easy to ignore everything else and kind of that excitement of getting into that. And wasn't really sitting too much after leaving staff, which I think is sadly all too common for people. They will leave and kind of just drop it, but so I figured, I kind of hit a rough patch and wasn't really, after a few years, just not really happy with what I was doing and yada yada. And so I decided going back to school, and pursuing a degree in architecture would be the way to go, because, kind of always had this, before going to college, applied to an architecture school and just thought that was what I wanted to do. And so I figured, okay, I kind of missed my calling, but now I have this chance, and got support from family, from Donna, from friends. And so was encouraged to do it. And anybody who knows anything about architecture school, it's kind of a real crazy, sadistic hazing experience, and the pay, if you end up getting a job afterwards, it's not good. I mean, it's not worth it. At least if you go through the hell training as a doctor, you get some decent money. But so in the fall of 2007, I went to my first semester, and I was trying to figure out how to work this in here. I'm gonna throw it in later, maybe go a bit more detail, but let's see. Yeah, it was just looking back. It was looking at the progression of things in school. It just seemed like it's like there were just so many signals and so many reminders of kind of the fragility of life and death and all these things. So fall of 07, my first semester. Okay, I'm all excited and really jazzed up and. Then like a month into it, I got a call that my dad had been diagnosed with multiple myeloma, a form of cancer that's a blood cancer. And really rare, not hereditary, there's still not a lot known about it. He had just retired a little while before, like a year or two before, and he and my stepmom were all excited and, got their house done in Florida. And I think a few years before that, if he had gotten that diagnosis, and at this time, the diagnosis basically was, people his stage have 2 years to live. And a couple years before that, probably wouldn't have affected me too much because I, honestly didn't have a very strong relationship with my dad. Not good or bad, just really not there. But a couple of years beforehand, in 2005, I went with him down to North Carolina. We went on a car trip to take care of his father. His father had just died, my grandfather. And so we were going down to pack up stuff and bring his mother up here. And so we started, just bonded the most we had ever in my whatever 30-something years at the time, and so that kind of threw me off, like, oh, geez, I just finally was getting to know my dad, and now it's, in a couple of years, he'll be gone, but to jump to the end of that one, he was fortunate to get diagnosed and get this cancer, just as all these new treatments and medicines were coming on, so this was 07. He's still alive and doing quite well. Stem cell treatments and all that fun stuff. What made it harder was that my stepmom, her father died of the same thing when she was a teenager, and so this really threw her off. So that was fall of 07. The next semester, spring of 08, get a call. My stepsister. So my stepmom's daughter, she was in a severe car accident. It was really, really, close call is like the sort of thing that if it were just something where a little bit, 2 inches another way, probably could have been severely paralyzed or killed. The next semester, fall of 08, get a call. My younger cousin, he was in a car crash, drinking and driving. He and a friend, I still don't know who was driving at the time, but it doesn't really matter. It was his car. So he was in a coma and in a vegetative state, and then so his parents had to decide to turn off the life support because he was pretty much gone. So then the following spring, people may remember that spring of 09, or I think it was February of 09, there was a plane crash in Buffalo where a Continental flight just dropped out of the air during an ice storm and went to a house. And come to find out that that was the flight that my other cousin, the sister of the one who just died in the car accident, she should have been on, but she was homesick. She was a flight attendant, and that was her normal route going from Newark to Buffalo for commuting to work. So it was just kind of another little thing. And then my grandmother, she come to find out afterward, talking about not opening up about family health issues and just kind of that the way that we hide everything, so in retrospect, most likely my grandmother had dealt with depression for all of her life, and just looking at some of the clues and, you know, what, just remembering certain things or what things were said. And then my uncle, her son, my mom's brother, he was always the kind of the weird uncle. We never heard from him. He just was, you know, always home, didn't go out, just watch TV and, you know, would just laugh. Ah, he's, you know, that's just Uncle Stan. He's just weird. But likely dealing with major depression or some other mental illness. So the fall of 09, I was planning to quit school. I took a leave of absence. It was just, it just was too much. I felt like I was going down this narrowing dark tunnel that was just getting tighter and tighter. And for whatever reason, my pride or not willing to quit, I just kept pushing along and not really taking a look at the rest of my life or how it's affecting myself and others. And again, hadn't been really sitting much, maybe going to a Sunday Tay show every other month or something, if that. So I realized, okay, I gotta figure something out here and seek some help. So ended up going to my doctor and, you know, talking things over. Got diagnosed with what's referred to as dysthymia. So it's kind of this low grade depression, just ongoing, and then occasionally you can get the severe drops into a severe depressive episode. And looking back, I that makes complete sense. Just seeing kind of always having a kind of a negative outlook on things and kind of a dark sense of humor growing up, and so that I could relate to that. And then that's what the same woman, Linda Holmes, who was in that last podcast, she referred to the same thing, so it was really relatable here.
It's hard to tell because the world is sort of horrible, so when you feel like the world is horrible, you don't know if you're depressed or merely accurate.
Well, and the other thing is, if it's been the way you've felt your whole life, you have very little to compare it to. No, people rarely sit down and say, how do you feel most of the time on a scale of 1 to 10? Because the doctor said to me before, you know, this was after I had had kind of this explosive depressive episode that had ultimately gotten me to a psychiatrist, but when that finally happened, and she said, you know, before this happened, for most of your life, how happy do you feel like you were most of the time? I said, 6, you know, and this is all out of 10. And she sort of said, you know, most people say it about an 8 or 9 when they're feeling good. And I was surprised by that. So, you know, go figure.
And let's see here. Yeah, so, I mean, I think that definitely relates to that. And I think maybe that kind of, whatever situation, that condition really would kind of prevent me from bouncing back after little things, and then just kind of added up and just could really snowball. And then talking with Errol recently, she just, as many people know, she just had a hip surgery, and she was talking about her pain management right now, dealing with that, and how her doctor said that on a scale from 1 to 10, she should try to avoid getting over a 4 with the pain, because once it gets over that, then things start to really get inflamed, and it's hard to get back down from one of those higher levels because the inflammation in the body and just that reaction. So it's kind of, I related it to that, and kind of the kind of a tipping point where it's a slippery slope, and it's hard to maintain a footing on that. Let's see. Of course, it's taking longer to do this than I had hoped for, so I'm going to try not to go too long and maybe leave some time for any questions or comments. So stuff sucked really bad for a while there. But One analogy I was thinking, like, for people who, you know, kind of the mind state is, you know, anybody who's dealt with a computer that freezes up and just a beach ball spinning and spinning, it's like that's just kind of what it felt like. Just like, you know, I'm there. You can see the screen. You can see things. I'm sure people saw me, and you know, yeah, there's Tom. But you know, no matter how much you push the buttons, how much you try, it's frozen. It's not going to do anything. And that's that's kind of how my brain felt, just locking up. There was one time that Donna asked me to help her out doing some simple math, maybe for a recipe or something. It was something I could always easily do in my head, and I just couldn't do it. And I just remember just breaking down and crying because I was like, what the hell is going on with me? This is ridiculous. So another clip from this guy. This is from the On Being episode, The Soul and Depression as well. Parker J. Palmer, he's an author, educator, and activist who focuses on issues in education, community leadership, spirituality, and social change. He is the founder and senior partner of the Center for Courage and Renewal. And he mentioned somewhere in there he's part of the Quaker tradition, and I think from early on, and maybe somehow involved in the Quaker church, but he really struck something with me hearing him talk. But let's see. So yeah, this is him talking about suicide.
I knew of Parker Palmer as a guru of the soul, a wise Quaker thinker whose books and speeches had helped people integrate their deepest spiritual values into their lives and work. And yet here was a revelation by Parker Palmer that he had suffered two episodes of crippling depression in his 40s.
People walk around saying, I don't understand why so-and-so committed suicide. Well, I understand perfectly why people take their lives. They need the rest. Depression is absolutely exhausting. It's why day by day for months at a time I wanted to take my life. What I don't understand is why some people come through on the other side and reclaim life with new vividness and with new intensity. That is the real mystery to me.
Yeah, so I'll say I was never, I was never really there at the precipice of committing suicide, but it was when kind of thoughts would creep in where it's like, man, just, you know, this is no way to live. I'd just rather be dead than this. Like, how, you know, is this going to last forever? And that whole downward spiral of negativity and negative thoughts. And I just remember watching the news one time, and there was like a car accident and somebody was killed. And I just remember thinking, oh, geez, lucky them, you know. It was kind of at that point I was like, that's not normal. That's not healthy. I think that's when I realized, okay, I need to get help. But what was scary is that it was so rational. It seemed so normal and rational, and just the fact that thought would creep in there. So like you said, it doesn't surprise me that when you hear of people doing that, and it's, you know, and you see a obituary and somebody says their life, you know, or whatever, they died suddenly, and it's like, you know, I think it's kind of one of those things we just keep private and sweep under the rug. Let's see. Yeah, I remember thinking, you know, I wasn't, at this point, I wasn't really accepting, you know, that depression was a real disease, or, you know, it was just something, yeah, growing up, it was always something that, it's just a sadness and people can't suck it up. This is a disease made up by the pharmacy companies and yada yada, and, you know, and looking back, you know, in this society, in the U.S., you know, all the ads for antidepressants at the time, which, you know, came about in the 90s, really, and they're always involved, you know, they always showed women in the ads, so because, you know, obviously it's, men don't get it. We're too resilient and strong for that. But I'm sure there was some marketing reason for doing that, figuring, okay, we can get it out there and women will you know, at least admit it and it'll be socially acceptable. And what struck me was one time we took a trip to New Zealand in 2006 or 7, and I always enjoy watching TV in other countries to get a sense of, you know, what, you know, differences in cultures and whatnot. And I remember being struck by this ad that popped up on TV of this big burly guy, and he's some sort of famous rugby player, and it wasn't an ad from a drug company. It was a, you know, PSA announcement thing, and he's talking about how, you know, I got depression, and go talk to your doctor, and there are medications for it. And I remember we met with Amala Sensei and Richard. We're driving, and I mentioned that to them, and Amal's like, oh yeah, that's so and so, you know, from the national rugby team, and yeah, blah, blah, blah. And it just really struck me how, like, that was, hey, okay, it's out in the open there, and it's okay. But at that time, I still, you know, I had no sense of being depressed or didn't identify with it. It was just, I just saw that contrast in the way ads are the advertising. So when I was being diagnosed, and going through all the testing and stuff, you know, I just remember hoping that, you know, I was like, there's no way that this could be depression. It's just, I mean, I feel so crappy. I've got to be really sick. I've got to be sick with something. It's, you know, it's not depression. And, you know, I remember hoping it was, like a brain tumor or something, because at least then it was something that can, you know, whatever is can be the cause. Trying to move along. For me, it was really difficult to start trying antidepressants. I found it humorous afterwards, a little bit of irony that, you know, in my early years, all the self-medicating that I did, and I had no problem, you know, smoking a bag of weed that came from some guy who knows a guy who knows a guy, or eating, you know, whatever, some hallucinogen that who knows where it came from. But, oh yeah, no problem. But when it came to having an antidepressant pill that is, you know, gone through all the rigors and testing and all this, for whatever reason, I couldn't trust it, or it was tough. But looking back, God bless the pharmaceutical companies. Sure, there's a bunch of capitalist greedy scumbags in the industry, but at the same time, they do some good things, as anybody can attest. Because I think it appears that probably within at least in the psychological or psychiatric world, it sounds like it's probably a common comparison for doctors and people to say, you know, Why would you hesitate taking a medication for depression? Because if you were diagnosed with a heart disease or high blood pressure, this or that, like, would you hesitate taking a pill for that? Like, what's the difference? I'm definitely not alone. There's that sense of, you know, I'm afraid I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to really be me. I'm going to be some drugged up version. And somebody in one of these podcasts mentioned, you know, this idea of real and artificial and what is your true self, and comparing it to, you said something like, if all of your teeth were to fall out at 30 years old, would you not get dentures because they're not really you? Or, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm wearing glasses. Should I just go around blind because it's not really me? Like, what, you know? So that it was again in the fog of depression. It's logic doesn't really exist. So let's see. Therapy was good. Long story short, therapy good. I think it was helpful for me just to understand, looking back, that grad school, the stressors of that, and you know, not dealing with things, yada yada, and but it also, I mean, the psychiatrist I talked with said, you know, she confirmed that, yeah, it's not that you're just whatever dwelling in negative thoughts, and that it's, you know, clearly something hereditary, and you know, it's manageable. People can manage it. Let's see, this will be too long to, oh yeah, I was going to mention, I said before school and before the whole going through my education, going back to the school, people who were at the Rohatsu Sesshin a couple of years ago, maybe remember, my little impromptu, encouragement talk on the last night of Sesshin, and, for people who don't know, so there's a if you haven't been to Sesshin and understand makyos and kind of these little hallucinations and just kind of these mind states that you can get in. This was, as Roshi said, this is somewhere in the top three that he's ever seen. So don't be put off by going to Sesshin and fearing this. You know, you're not at risk. But yeah, I recall being there and just recalling all of that, and I realized I just kind of stuck it away, put it down deep, and you know, it was like this kind of knot that was just kind of sitting there and just never really addressed it. And just a month or two before that is when I came back on staff here, and so I just remember sitting there in Sesshin and just as remembering all that, and it was kind of a release, and that knot, that thing of a knotted muscle being released, and just being overwhelmed with this sense of just appreciation and feeling so lucky to be back on staff, and realizing, you know, that was the first time in my life that I felt like I was kind of really where I needed to be, or it felt right, kind of. Wasn't always looking for something else or trying to figure out who I was. Just being in that mind state last night of Sesshin, and just kind of being overwhelmed with this rush of warm and fuzzy emotions, and I kind of came up with the idea, I recalled, oh, this would be a great encouragement talk, and, oh, gee, I bet I could, oh, it would really be inspirational to people, and then, you know, then I had the vision of myself standing up in front of the Zendo, and, you know, kind of typical fear of public speaking, and all of a sudden this kind of anxious shot of adrenaline popped in, and I used to be kind of an adrenaline junkie as a way of dealing with whatever issues, and so mountain biking, snowboarding, and all this, and trying to just push the limits, and so it had been a while since I'd experienced any sort of adrenaline rush, and it was just, whoa, like just this crazy, crazy high. And yeah, for some reason, I decided it would be a great idea to stand up there during the final night and try to give an encouragement talk. And it's just all a blur. And now when I think back to it, I just get this horrible knot in my stomach. Just feel like I'm going to throw up. But yeah, so. That was good. That was. I was planning on putting that in a Zenbo article, but decided. Yeah. Like I said. Anyway. So. Yeah. I came across an interesting article. I'm not going to read this because it's going to go too long. But This was on the blog on the Scientific American website, April 2nd, just a few weeks ago, and it's talking about physicians, depression, and burnout, and this young woman, Jennifer Tsai, T-S-A-I, talking about her experience in medical school and just compared to the general population, female physicians are 2.3 times more likely to die by suicide, which overall is the third most common cause of death for women of ages 25 to 34. So going through all that, and if anybody is interested in reading that, it was just really revealing, and and you know, hearing the stats of people in the law profession and medical profession just dealing with burnout, and you know, I think this is more what's considered a situational severe depressive episode when it's caused by this kind of stress and when you're in that situation, you start developing bad habits, bad eating habits, bad sleeping habits, and working into that. Let's see here. Yeah, so I guess stepping back even further, I didn't realize until more recently that my first really severe depressive episode was such, because it was kind of in a different context. And when I was first on staff, and I came on staff in 2000, and I was out of Chapin Mill, we were building the retreat center, and felt great. I felt where I needed to be, and at that point I'd only been sitting for a year or two, did a couple sashins, and still was whatever, some young guy who knew better than everybody or whatever, the ego. So this series of events that transpired that, looking back and seeing it just makes sense. But so in the summer, one summer, the second summer there, I banked up some time to go hiking, so to take a couple of weeks off for my summer break. And so I had 2 weeks off, and I'd always wanted to do a long hike, backpacking trip, so I was able to do that and went to Vermont and hiked part of the long trail there, and just amazing experience, and that's a whole nother story, but anybody who has done so or just spent any times out in the woods for a few days just understands. So I got back, and I think then I was moving in Arnold Park. I was moving up into the second floor of 5AP. I think it was maybe it's Jack's room now. I remember unpacking there, and I still had one day of my break left, so I was just kind of unpacking and whatever, cleaning up and just kind of getting back into the civilized world. And so it was tea break, and I remember going, I'm going to go get tea break. And then just as I was going down the stairs, Roshi's coming up. He's like, go get your tea and come up to the library. I was like, what? And so now everybody else is going up, and what's going on? And TV's going, and it was 9/11. And we're watching the Twin Towers burn. And it was just such a, I just remember just being in a state of shock just watching that. Just anybody who recalls that, and just after being in the woods for 2 weeks or 1.5 weeks, and then boom, it's like, oh. And so I wanted to check with Roshi last week or week before going into this, just to make sure he didn't see any problems with relating this. But yeah, so after 9/11, that just definitely shifted something in me, and I think a big part of it was so afterwards we gathered down in the library, or in the dining room rather, and just kind of doing a little circle and checking in, and that was the first time I saw Roshi cry. I mean, he just broke down sobbing at just the, I mean, just the, and something in that just shifted something in me to make me realize, you know, before that it was kind of, oh, he's Roshi. I kind of put him up on the pedestal and, you know, would try to throw stones at him, knock him down or whatever, and just, and that was the first thing that made it, I was like, okay, you know, like, oh man, you know, he's real. he's a human being. He's not, you know, I always had these ideas. He, whatever, putting on a show or something. And yeah, that just, really, really, made him real. So that really inspired me to really, take my practice more serious. And it was that following October Sesshin that is when he passed me on the on the koan mu, and it was really just that yeah, it was that mind state to be in there. And before that, I realized I wasn't really trying, wasn't really putting forth any effort, and just thinking, okay, whatever, this koan thing or this Zen thing, you know, okay, yeah. Maybe there's something to it, but da da da, and you know, as Roshi will often recount, Roshi Kaplow's mentioning of just wanting to get Kensho and running, and you know, all right, thank you, be on my way, and that was good. So that was kind of the mindset I was in, but and then yeah, so I brought that up to say, because even after doing that, after passing Mu, and then that's when, not long after is when I left staff, and I was like, all right, well, I guess, you know, hey, I passed Mu, that's, you know, that's good enough for me, I can move on, and, you know, I did the Zen thing, and, you know, let's move on with life. And yeah, so then after that was all the stuff with school and yada yada yada. Let's see, it is almost 10:30. Should I wrap it up, John? Or one thing I definitely want to get in there is just mentioning, you know, you know, this feeling of isolation and whatnot, and just really dawning on me, you know, I think it was another one of the podcasts people, somebody mentioned, like, yeah, as a straight white male, I've got a good support system to fall back on if, you know, if I'm in this shape, and, you know, I've got health care, I can go to wherever. But anybody who's in any one of the many marginalized communities or parts of society, it's a little bit different situation, I'm sure. And this one on this podcast, the hilarious World of Depression, he interviews this guy Reggie Aussie, and he is known as Combat Jack, or was known as Combat Jack, on a podcast. And so this interview that he did was conducted of this past October, and then he died in December of colon cancer. He was an important figure in the hip-hop scene as a lawyer for, like, many of the big names, Jay-Z and Kanye, and he was an editor, podcast host, and somebody in that scene. But I think he did a great job of just kind of describing what it's like to be a black man.
There's a lot of depression in the black community that we've been trained or conditioned to ignore or to move past. And I don't think, when you think about issues affecting the black community, you don't think about depression.
Conditioned to move past in yourself or in the community?
I think primarily in yourself, and as a greater part of yourself as a community. I've heard stories, you know, on my show, the Combat Jack Show, the podcast, I've always been a proponent for mental health. And I get, you know, I get these stories from some of the listeners that are just amazing. And one story in particular that stands out, a young man reached out to me. I think he was in his early 20s, and I think he was from the West Coast. And he really thanked me for doing that show. And he shared with me a story that affected his life. He got shot, I think, when he was 16 or 17 years old. After surviving such a traumatic experience, he was really afraid to go outside. And his neighborhood teased him. They teased him like, dude, why don't you fucking man up? Like, why don't you come out? Like, why don't you, are you not a tough guy? You're not a man anymore? And, you know, he had to live through that until he heard, you know, us addressing that this is an issue in the neighborhood and our communities. Think about that. Like, think about him not being able to feel, not even being aware. It's not even being able, not even being aware that his physical trauma impacted him mentally.
Did he think of it as just, I'm so scared after this? Or did he see it as, there's a condition here, there's a mental illness?
I think the more he learned from our show, from whatever else that he researched, he realized that he did have an issue or condition. But prior to that, I think he struggled with, like most of us struggle in our communities, what's wrong with me?
Yeah, I have a lot more that we just don't have time, but I definitely do want to open it up to questions. I've been following the latest research and stuff. I've been really looking at that and kind of really hopeful of, you know, like in many areas of the health and science realm, there's just been such a transformation and discoveries as we find out new things. But gosh, so much I wanted to do. I've got to play this one because this is to sum it up here. So again, this is the Parker Palmer, the Quaker guy here.
When you were talking about how Quaker tradition, that just that people know how to be silent, I was recalling that passage in what you've written about your depression, about the friend who helped you the most, who would just come be with you.
Right. This I'll just tell that story quickly because it's such a great image for me. I had folks coming to me, of course, who wanted to be helpful, and sadly, many of them weren't. These were the people who would say, gosh, Parker, why are you sitting in here being depressed? It's a beautiful day outside. Go, you know, feel the sunshine and smell the flowers. And that, of course, leaves a depressed person even more depressed, because while you know intellectually that it's sunny out and that the flowers are lovely and fragrant, you can't really feel any of that in your body, which is dead in a sensory way. And so you're left more depressed by this, quote, good advice to get out and enjoy the day. And then other people would come and say something along the lines of, gosh, Parker, why are you depressed? You're such a good person. You've helped so many people.
You're so successful
and you've written so well. And that would leave me feeling more depressed because I would feel I've just defrauded another person who, if they really knew what a schmuck I was, would cast me into the darkness where I already am. Mm. There was this one friend who came to me after asking permission to do so every afternoon about 4 o'clock, sat me down in a chair in the living room, took off my shoes and socks and massaged my feet. He hardly ever said anything. He was a Quaker elder. And yet, out of his intuitive sense, from time to time would say a very brief word, like, I can feel your struggle today, or farther down the road, I feel that you're a little stronger at this moment, and I'm glad for that. But beyond that, he would say hardly anything. He would give no advice. He would simply report from time to time what he was sort of intuiting about my condition. Somehow he found the one place in my body, namely the soles of my feet, where I could experience some sort of connection to another human being. Mm-hmm. And the act of massaging, just, you know, in a way that I really don't have words for, kept me connected with the human race. What he mainly did for me, of course, was to be willing to be present to me in my suffering. He just hung in with me in this very quiet, very simple, very tactile way.
Yeah, so there's a good website, makeitokay.org, which kind of goes through a list of things to say or don't say to somebody. And, you know, you don't say, just deal with it, snap out of it, could be worse. You don't say those kind of things. It's not helpful. To bring it back to the Zen practice, realizing more and more, you know, how profound this practice is, and realizing that over the millennia, you know, it's probably a similar situation of what many people have dealt with who've come to this path to try to seek relief from suffering. But I guess I can say that it's I don't think I have to tell anybody here. I'm preaching to the choir. So if anybody, I have a lot more stuff. If anybody did want to check in with me some other time, I'd be happy to pass stuff on. But if there's time for questions, it's 10:37 right now. I'm sure people really want bagels and coffee. I know I do. I'll leave it to John and Truman to work it out here. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody who has something they'd like to ask, we have a minute or two.
Yeah, I just have, I don't, it's not really a question, it's just a comment. It's just like, dude, I had no idea. And we started practicing together around the same time in the late night. So
yeah.
It's really, yeah, thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
And did a good job of keeping it under wraps.
a lot of practice over the years, hiding, yeah.
I can make a comment. I go through it too. And I wear the mask.
Yeah. I'm, you know, like I said, I think it's something that so many people deal with or have dealt with, and it's just, you know, our culture doesn't let us be open about it, and we have to live with a sort of a shame or stigma, and I couldn't imagine, like I said, being a straight white male. I couldn't imagine being marginalized in any other way, and having to go through that without any support system. But I'm hopeful that airing this out will maybe inspire people to be a bit more open and kind of find some relief and seek out support.
Tom, thank you for getting the perspective over time of how things built up in you, because I think, you know, I can relate to that very well. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. From what I've read, it's, you know, for many people, it doesn't really surface until the 30s or 40s. Of course, there's teenagers who, I couldn't imagine being a teen and with all the other crap going on in my brain at the time and the whole mess of hormones and whatnot and trying to figure that out. But there's a lot of good resources, and like I said, the podcast just really did something for me to hear in such a personal way, hear these different people's experiences, and just a really, really therapeutic medium.
Tom, my son Benjamin had clinical depression that came on when he was 13.
Hmm.
And I'm not sure how much my going through a divorce and all of that had to do with it, but he had a very hellish situation for a number of years in which he had a whole lot of difficulty sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal loss of appetite. And all this went on until he was about... and he had a whole hell of a lot of different medications, one after another. Until he called me. It was after he was working after college, and he called me and just said, "I'm in trouble."
Hmm.
And I just said, "I'll be there in 4 hours." He was in Cleveland.
Yeah.
And I went there, and I, you know, I'm a Rolfer, so I put my hands on him and got him calmed down, and then it's 1 or 2 days later, he told me that he had just taken himself off a very potent psychotropic drug and was basically going through withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a phenomenal amount of respect for him because he did that. He never went back to any medication. He instead began to work out.
Mm-hmm.
Rather religiously.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still working out religiously.
Mm-hmm.
But he is... I'm just very... proud of him and the way he can't say overcame it.
Yeah, it's
because I'm not sure that you ever really. It's like my bipolar. I don't think it's something you ever really overcome. It's just with us.
Mm-hmm. You learn to move with it. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Tom, I think we should pull the plug here. We're
yeah.
15 minutes over.
Coffee, bagels.
I vow to liberate endless line I vow to uproot the Armageddon. Beyond measure, I vow to penetrate the breakaway of God. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless lying passions. I vow to uproot.
and we're in the middle of an all-day sitting, so that will resume, but I'm guessing we'll move the start of the next block back a little bit.
Yeah, I hit the big bell at 5 minutes past, and so we get back in the zone for 10:10. So, like 25 minutes.
Oh, 11:10.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Too busy thinking about coffee. Get the time right.
Let's see. Might as well tell people right now, next Sunday, Roshi will give a Taisho. It's after a workshop. So, yeah, there's a workshop on Saturday coming up. Usual stuff with that. But next Sunday, Roshi will be giving Taisho. And then afterwards, we're going to do a little bit for to mark his 70th birthday, which happened already. But this is the first chance we'll have as a Sangha to get together and, you know, give him some grief. When he turned 60, one of his sisters sent me just a treasure trove of adorable and embarrassing pictures of Roshi throughout his childhood. And I have all of those.
Oh.
And, yeah, we'll you know, find a white wall somewhere and show them if you come.
A few of you may have noticed that on the calendar is a meeting of the Zen Drying Group today at 11 o'clock.
Going to make that a little later?
Well, I guess we'll have to. It's 10:47. Okay. I'd say 11:05 or something like that.
Sorry, I screwed everything up. I'm no good. That's too bad. Living or dying.
Everything.
All right. Thank you.